The following contains strong language, violence, and nudity. It is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
Wizard First Series Hollow Foil Bordered Cards. Number 2, Jim Valentino's Shadowhawk. Real name unknown. Group affiliation none. Age unknown. Height unknown. Weight unknown. First appearance, Youngblood number 2, June 1992, Image Press. Created and illustrated by Jim Valentino. Feeling that the court system is too lenient on criminals, Shadowhawk takes a new approach to those he apprehends. Instead of letting them slip through the revolving door of justice, he sentences them to life imprisonment by breaking their spines and paralyzing them for life. This puts him at odds with the underworld, the police force, and even the other heroes of the Image universe. Among friends and foes alike, Shadowhawk is a wanted man. Excerpt from Inside Image, issue number 3, cover dated May 1993, Shadowhawk. An interview with Jim Valentino by Hank Cannells. Jim Valentino. Shadowhawk 2 will be a miniseries with 3 issues. The way I currently see Shadowhawk is not conducive to an ongoing series. There will be a series of miniseries. There are 5 planned so far. The first one was subtitled Out of the Shadows, which happens to be the name of the trade paperback. The second one is subtitled The Secret Revealed. In it, Shadowhawk is going to take off the mask. I believe we can go deeper inside the character's head and examine the psychology of why he does this. Plus, in August, we plan to release something called Images of Shadowhawk. It will be an ongoing series by other people, and will deal with other creators' visions of the characters. We tentatively have scheduled Keith Giffen and Alan Grant, those fun guys who brought you Lobo. Then we have scheduled a story written by Chris Wozniak, who's really turned into a great writer as well as being a great artist. And it's illustrated by the guy who would have originally done Shadowhawk had it been a Marvel comic, Mark Texeira. We're still working on the paperwork, but I'm fairly certain it's going to happen. And our third scheduled story arc will be by the creators of Faust, Tim Vigil and David Quinn. To one degree or another, there's still a lot about the character that we won't tell, like his secret origin, where he got the costume, and if he made it, his method of operations, and how he gets things done. A lot of this remains unknown to the reader for now. Issue number 1 features a blind embossed die-cut cover. It's the first time this has been done. The blind embossing will be on the Shadowhawk figure, and all the silver parts of his costume will be die-cut out. Underneath the cover will be a highly reflective mirror-type process, which will feature a stunning version of the red-eyed helmet against the black backdrop. We believe that it will be a more striking cover than that which appeared on Shadowhawk number 1. There won't be an actual cover enhancement for the second issue, but it is the issue where Shadowhawk reveals his identity. The third cover, if we can pull it off, is destined to be one of the coolest covers ever. It'll be the first cover to pull up, not pull out. Basically, it will be 3 lengths high. Shadowhawk will be lifting his mask off so readers can actually animate Shadowhawk and pull off his mask. We're trying to do inventive things with the covers that enhance the book, rather than gimmicks which force multiple purchases. Vendetta will be back, along with her regulators. I don't think that there will be room for any Image Universe guest stars in the second series. Chance Wolfe will be returning as inker. I really like the luster he adds to the art, and readers seem to like it as well. We've got enough of a head start so that we'll keep on schedule, knock on wood. We're not going to be monthly, but we're not going to have to wait a full 2 months either.
I hate the rain. I've always hated rain. I always will. I am not motivated by revenge. I'm only interested in justice. Under my rules, the guilty get punished. I catch them in the act of committing violent crimes. I deal with them. My methods seem harsh, even brutal to some. I don't care. Society is better off without these scum running loose. And my time is running out. Time. This time, it's different. This time, someone's using my name. This time, it's personal.
Solicitation copy for Images of Shadowhawk number 1. When Carmen, the blowhole Oliveri, decides to turn in state's evidence, Shadowhawk finds himself in the unenviable position of having to see to it that the little weasel survives long enough to testify. Considering the fact that Carmen's broken back was Shadowhawk issue, this is a particularly bitter pill for Shadowhawk to swallow. But the amount of scum that Carmen can take down, mostly drug-related, helps in choking that pill down. Unfortunately, one Gideon Trencher is in town, and Carmen's name is on the top of his list of folks to repossess. Add in the Twilight Runners, a gang of body-hopping paranormals contracted to see to it that Carmen never makes it to court, and you've got a night that Shadowhawk will never forget. Excerpt from Inside Image issue number 7, cover dated September 1993. Trencher comes to Shadowhawk's land. Images of Shadowhawk. Keith Given interview by Lynn Senecal. As various Image creators were getting in touch with me, trying to convince me that Image was the way to go, Jim was also calling and was one of the most incredibly persistent. When I finally decided to take the plunge and go in for the Trencher book, My Little Island at Image, Jim happened to mention that he was working on this idea to do a Shadowhawk book along along the lines of DC's Dark Knight, wherein the creators would come in and do their riffs on Shadowhawk. Jim asked me if I would be interested in doing the first three. I thought it'd be kind of hot to play around with the Shadowhawk character. Then when the opportunity arose to bring the Trencher character in as sort of a crossover thing and really do a kind of an over-the-top Shadowhawk, that locked it in for me. All I'm doing is really building off of what Jim did. One thing I keep in mind when doing an assignment like Images of Shadowhawk is that the character's not mine. Jim's been really good about this in that he gives you a lot of latitude in the way that you handle Shadowhawk, as long as you keep the character consistent. Thank God Jim is not one of those people that's into the real anal continuity of book, but he does insist that the character be consistent in his appearances. Whatever restrictions there are, they are very few. That was the basic attraction, pitting Shadowhawk almost against himself. One thing that I liked that Jim went along with was that these are not two heroes who will fight one another and suddenly decide, well, we're both on the same side, let's team up and go after the real enemy. When this story is over, I can pretty much guarantee these two guys hate one another, and if they ever run across each other again, they're just going to start up where they left off. These are not two quote-unquote heroes teaming up. These are two pretty well twisted individuals coming up against one another. If anyone's familiar with the Trencher book, they can tell that I do it kind of loopy sometimes, and the Trencher book does have kind of a tongue-in-cheek, almost parody aspect to it. But when you're walking into Shadowhawk's world, you play by Shadowhawk's rules, so it's going to be a grimmer, more determined Trencher. Sort of like Trencher by way of Michael Myers in the Halloween movies. This force that just keeps coming at you and all you can do is try to withstand. Those are the kind of stories that I like. I like stories that have a real solid conflict at the core. Anything else that comes around, it just really enriches it. I like Alan's dialogue. He's got that very irreverent kind of writing approach that people immediately identify with the British writers. But there's not attitude in his writing. It's good, clean, straightforward writing. Alan seems to be the most straightforward writer in terms of good, solid superhero adventure. And yet he co-created Judge Dredd. So you can tell that he does have a little streak of black humor running through him. He seems to realize that we're doing comic books, and comic books should be fun. And that's the bottom line. If you're not having fun, then geez, why put yourself through all of this? What experience have you had previously with Keith Giffen?
You know what? Nothing comes to mind. I feel like I'm a bad comic fan because of that, but I just, you know, I didn't read a lot of DC.
And you weren't a Defenders guy, so you wouldn't have been around for that.
Yeah, I think I just always kind of avoided his stuff. He never worked on Iron Man or anything like that. So, I obviously know Keith Giffen. He's a big deal. He's a weird, like, who is Keith Giffen in the Hall of Comic Dumb? Overrated, underrated, properly rated? He's probably underrated. Or is he properly rated?
Maybe. I kind of think properly, honestly, because he's had some pretty severe lows, and most people kind of gloss over that, but his highs have been high enough and people hold him in regard, and there's a great enthusiasm for his work to this day, a lot of nostalgia, but also it's a lot of the work just holds up. So I would say actually this is an instance of being properly rated. You know, the fact that the guy's still working after starting out back in the 70s, how many guys who are working in the 70s can still get work today?
Right. Klaus Janson.
Not in recent years. I mean, he had a good run, but not in recent years. I don't think he's done anything. He was writing a miniseries for Image a few years back, and it got canceled pretty quickly, or you know, they stopped producing it fairly quickly. I think they got a trade's worth of material at most, and it just disappeared.
I mean, that was a joke. Okay. not a lot. I'd say this might be the only Keith Giffen stuff I've ever actually read. Right? I mean, did he write this stuff, The Image of Shadowhawk?
He plotted it, but I believe it's a situation where he just probably drew the whole story, and then he got the guy who had scripted Lobo with him to do the writing on it, which is interesting because he did not have a scripter when he was doing the Trencher series. It was all him on his own for the most part. So it's interesting that he actually brought in a professional scripter to do Shadowhawk. Might have been at the suggestion of Valentino. I mean, I have to assume that Valentino's paying these guys, so it might have been, hey, Keith, I think let's go ahead and bring in a scripter for this one, because that's I think the only time Keith ever had a scripter on a Trencher story.
Gotcha. Interesting.
And you haven't had any exposure to Trencher previously, I'm sure.
I listened to a Spotometer episode about it.
So you got the basics at least down.
Yeah.
So what happens in this one?
Okay, it's a 3-issue miniseries. As you said, it's writer-artist Keith Giffen, dialogue by Alan Grant, colorist Clydene Nee.
And I think this is important, and the separations are by in color. Laverne Kanzierski did the coloring on the main Trencher material. It's very distinctive coloring, and because of the art style, I think very difficult to color. Yeah. And I think that the coloring in this book suffers for having to color Keith Giffen under these circumstances, because you can tell that this doesn't look like a Trencher book, but it's drawn like a Trencher book, and the coloring just, there's some cognitive dissonance there. One major issue with the colorist on images of Shadowhawk is that they have Captain Frakes in this story and they color Frakes as a white dude, even though Giffen is clearly drawing a black dude with black dude hair. So it's very distracting that they just keep, for the entire miniseries, they never corrected. They just keep having a white Captain Frakes. So I find that very distracting.
Okay, so the story's pretty straightforward. I mean, yeah. Three issues.
Oh, before you get into the plot too, I'll just go ahead and say that Images of Shadowhawk number one was released on September 13th, 1993. This story takes place between Shadowhawk series 2 and series 3. Most of the issues came out during a delay between Trencher number 3 and number 4, number 4 being the final issue that Image Comics produced. Unsurprisingly, issues 1 and 2 had about a 5-week gap, but then number 3 didn't come out until 3 months later, toward the end of January of 1994. Giffen was likely drawing material for his new publisher, Black Ball Comics, and the Trencher Xmas Bites Holiday Blowout number 1 came out 2 weeks before Image's number 3. So you can see that it wasn't that he wasn't producing material, he just wasn't getting this story done, apparently. The story features Gideon Trencher, who's already been established, and we've already done an episode on that character, as well as the voice in his head, Phoebe.
The story starts off with Shadowhawk having just beat down and criminal, as he tends to do, and breaks the dude's back, as he tends to do. We go over to... So there's a gunshots heard, so Shadowhawk runs to the gunshots, and Trencher's there, and he's just blown some dude's brains out, and they begin to just fight. Like, it escalates rather quickly. And they're talking about how Shadowhawk has been standing guard over this dude named Blowhole, and basically who is an asthmatic, which is where he gets his name from. He's a mob informant who's in the hospital that he's trying to protect. So he's watching over this guy because everybody's trying to kill this informant, because if he goes to court, he's basically going to rat on everybody. So as he's waiting to do that, that's when he hears the gunshots, goes to where the gunfire was. It's Trencher, and they start fighting back and forth. They don't know who each other are. And Trencher just starts blowing him to pieces rather amazingly. The
how many, just a guesstimate, how many individual shots is Shadowhawk being riddled with in that given panel?
It's gotta be 40. And then the next panel 120, maybe. I mean, it's like
you can see every the individual drawing, and as you probably remember from the episode, apparently Giffen would just start drawing and the pen would not come off the paper until he finished either a panel or sometimes the whole page. So imagine just sitting there and doing every one of those little bullet shots right there.
Yeah, and they all overlap one another. I mean, it makes sense. Yeah, and he like blows him back into a car and just continue. I mean, and the shots now are not only all over his body, but on the ground and all over the car, because he's obviously just spraying the gunfire at him. Really incredible looking. You figure reading comic books, you've seen somebody get shot enough times.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I've ever seen two panels like this. Like, mm-hmm. It blew my mind looking at this. And then one of the shots hits the gas tank of the car and blows the whole thing up. And Shadowhawk, using his internal monologue, is like, oh, good Lord. Like, if I may survive this, but luckily that guy won't. And he gets up. And meanwhile, Trencher has taken his gun and he shot a fire hydrant that's put the water out. He gets up and leaves. And Shadowhawk is like dumbfounded. And his armor is just riddled with like divots from all the gunfire. Like, it's all over. So from there, they go to the mob guys talking about wanting to put this hit out on Blowhole. And
did you say the guy's name already? I you probably did. I might have missed it. That the guy, the mobster's name is Carmine the Blowhole Oliver.
I didn't say his whole name, but yeah, that's his name, Carmine the Blowhole Oliver. So yeah, they're talking to this guy. His name's Mr. Koink, or Koenig, mm-hmm. K-O-N-I-K. And he basically is the kingpin, and he's saying, we got to get rid of this dude. We've hired the, what are their names? The
Twilight Runners, I think they're called.
Twilight Runners. Yeah, the Twilight Runners gang is who they're going to use the mob's going to use to whack Blowhole. Meanwhile, we find out that Trencher is also going after Blowhole. So Shadowhawk's trying to protect the guy, the mob's going after the guy, and Trencher's been hired to go after the guy. Trencher gets to the hospital, the cops are there. Phoebe the entire time is telling him, you know what, this is a good idea with this many cops, why don't we just come back later, we can always do this again some other time. And he's like, no, we're taking care of this now.
Well, and they make a big point too, is she's always critiquing him and pointing out that he's way more violent than he needs to be, that he could definitely be more subtle, and he's constantly not listening to her good advice. And one thing that definitely comes up throughout the miniseries is she comes up with the theory that maybe he's just Jinx, next, because everything always seems to go wrong for this guy on every single assignment. At some point, maybe it's just you. And he really seems to be unnerved by her pointing out that he may be jinxed.
Yeah, he's like, enough with the jinx.
Getting back to the coloring too, I know they're trying to do some stylized shading and stuff, but there's a lot of panels where Trencher is just plain purple skinned, and he's not. It's just so peculiar. The coloring of that character is just way off throughout this miniseries. So while I was fresh in my mind, but what else happens in the story?
Okay, so Trencher is now going up through the hospital trying to get to Blowhole. Meanwhile, Shadowhawk has basically armored up because he knew just in case he comes in contact with this guy again. So he's put more guns and weapons on his armor. Trencher is marching his way through the hospital, blowing dudes away, trying not to kill cops, but he does kill cops. That gets a little, like, I feel like they contradict themselves in the third issue, because he's like, I never try and kill a cop, but I'm pretty sure he's blown some cops away in this first issue. Whatever.
Maybe it was like a T2 thing where no one died, some bullshit like that. Or just a get out of jail free so that people don't get pissed off. He's running around killing cops and he's like, I'm not killing any cops. And the art like clearly shows you killing cops. Just like with the Hulk, where obviously people had to die around the Hulk, but they never actually acknowledge that, when you have this sort of wanton destruction, people are going to have to die, but they never actually say it. So you've got plausible deniability.
No, I mean, he even says, if there's one thing I don't like, it's having to kill cops after he's blown these dudes away. And then I'm pretty sure in the third issue, he flat out says, I never kill NYPD or something like that. And he's like knocking them out instead. It was like really strange. Yeah. But whatever. It's not that big of a deal. So to avoid the cops, he jumps and starts climbing the side of the building, Hulk style. Mm-hmm. And as he's getting to the top, they're like, okay, well, you know what? Finally, I'm going to actually luck into something. He's like, see, I'm not jinxed. And then they're like, hey, he's up there. And they start just unloading on him while he's climbing up the building. And then he gets in through a window and he's like, all right, now this should be easy. This shouldn't be in it. I should be able to walk in there and off Blowhole. And as soon as he gets up there, Shadowhawk jumps out and attacks him. And now Shadowhawk's there.
And they're calling him Bird Boy of all things.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing that they are still being vague about the race of the character, because the boy part could have been an issue. If he'd leaned a little too hard on that second syllable, that could have caused some problems.
That would not have aged well at all. I mean, it wouldn't have been good at the time either. But from there, it's just a knockdown, drag out fight between Shadowhawk and Trencher. I mean, they're just destroying each other. And they're in, like, Shadowhawk's inner monologue just keeps going, I cannot believe this guy keeps moving and I can't move much longer. Like, my every bone in my body hurts. At one point he says, like, it feels like my arms have been pulled out of their sockets. Trencher's throwing him through walls, smashing his face in the ground, throwing him off the top of buildings. And there's a really good scene where he throws him on the top of the building. He shoots his grappling hook. It hooks onto the building. And then he, because the momentum carries him through like an around, and he's trying to avoid the side of the building so he doesn't smash into it, which is totally what would not normally happen in a comic book. Normally he would just either swing off like a superhero or whatever, but he's like cognizant of his own momentum, so he steers himself into like through a window, but he doesn't let go of the line because it's connected to him, right? It's connected to his arm, and it hooks him up into the room and then through the ceiling of the room. Like, it was pretty interesting the way he didn't just crash through the window. Because it got hooked on the top. Let's see, the line is gets snagged on the top of the window sill and continue now just pushes him up. It's hard to explain, folks, but if you saw it, you'd be like, oh, duh, that makes sense.
Easy to see, hard to describe.
Yeah. So let me see what happens from there. So Trencher then realizes, hey, this will be easy. I can just, the guy got away or whatever. Oh, no, he didn't, because I can just reel him in like a fish. So he just starts pulling him up, and now Shadowhawk's pulled out of the roof, crashes onto the ground, and then gets pulled back up through the window up to the rooftop but before that, he cuts his line, and then the four, he does the old pull the chair out kind of a deal. So Trencher's pulling with all of his force on the line, and because he cuts the line, the recoil throws Trencher back into a wall. Like, the attention to physics here over these two pages, I have some respect for, because normally, again, it's superhero comics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me see, where are we at now? So it's sort of the same deal. Trencher is like, okay, well, time to get back to business. I got to go find Blowhole, since Shadowhawk slung off into who knows where and he's still on top of the building. He can keep going looking for Blowhole. Meantime, the cops are there and they've got like backup, and these like mech droids have shown up. Then we go back to the mob, and the mob is talking about how they got somebody on the inside that's going to get Blowhole. And I don't think they quite reveal who that is yet. No, they do not. There's an awesome scene of, okay, no, it was this. This is the issue where he says it. So he's walking towards these cops. This is Trencher in the lobby, and they're just unloading on him. And it's just like when he was unloading on Shadowhawk, how there's just bullets all over his body. You can barely see the character because there's so many bullets hitting him. And then he says, I'll just have to go right through him. Well, at least you're not using your gun. He's like, you know me, Phoebe, never kill a cop, though sometimes you just got to pound them. And he's just beating these dudes up. And I'm like, you, like, literally 5 pages ago, you were killing cops. Maybe maybe it's just because he's, I don't know, maybe he's saying that sarcastically. I have no idea. Anyway, we move on. So now Shadowhawk's back in the hospital. He's beating up cops, trying to make sure the blowhole's okay. So he, Trencher was almost to Blowhole's room when Shadowhawk jumps back in. They start fighting again. Shadowhawk throws like a batarang at him, or a hawkarang, or whatever they are, and hits him like right between his eyes. And he's, and Shadowhawk's just like, who are you? Like, what are you? I remember in, I think the first issue, he was like, I think he's one of those blood strikes I've heard about on the news. Like, he obviously does not run into a lot of invincible powered zombies or whatever.
Well, it actually is kind of interesting because, you know, Trencher, they'd mentioned in an interview that Keith Giffen wanted to work his way toward Trencher meeting Spawn, which makes sense since you've got the whole undead connection. And then, of course, Giffen was writing Bloodstrike for a short time there. So it's interesting that he mentions two characters that would potentially be on his docket coming up. But the thing is the Savage Dragon had fought Shadowhawk previously, and Savage Dragons should be comparable to Trencher. So it really isn't that uncommon for him. But what's also weird is that this whole story arc, given the punishment that Shadowhawk is having to deal with, it's really about his perseverance. And it reminds me a lot of like a 3-issue version of that classic Daredevil story where he's got to do everything he can to just halt the progression of the Hulk and get him out of the city, no matter what toll it takes on him. Of course, by the end, he's in a body cast and shit. And I think that's what they're playing off of. But Shadowhawk had already kind of fought a Hulk-like character in the Savage Dragon in the previous miniseries.
Yeah, exactly. And that's very much what it's like. I mean, he's at no point really hurting Trencher. Like, but he's getting his ass whipped just constantly. But he keeps coming back for more and more and more. Like I said, he keeps his internal monologue. He's commenting on how just, I can't take much more of this. How am I still alive? How am I still walking? So from there, they just continue to beat the hell out of each other, folks. I don't know how else to describe this. So then we get to the Twilight Runners, right? So they basically talk about how there's a guy on the inside again. And you find out what it is. It was in the very first couple panels, in the very first couple pages, Shadowhawk had just beat some dude up. Well, that dude's in the hospital now. And it turns out these Night Runner dudes, am I saying their names right? Twilight. They're basically like little symbiote phantoms attached to your face. So that dude getting his ass beat and put into the hospital was basically how they snuck one of the guys in there. So they show the symbiote coming off of this knocked out, paralyzed criminal. So now the nurse is like walking around and she's their inside guy now. Oh man, here we go. So more fight, 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 kick, 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 fight, 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 fight. So now the mech guys are involved. And Trench sort of like is trying to have his drop the mic moment as Phoebe's telling him, just get out of there. There's still time to just leave. We can come back and kill this guy later when there's not so much heat. He grabs an oxygen tank, throws it in the air, shoots it with his gun, and just absolutely blows a hole in the side of this hospital. Like, this hospital is just annihilated already. And that's issue 2. Issue 3, guess what we're doing? More fight, 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 folks. At this point, Trencher's ripped Shadowhawk's helmet off. And again, they just continuously just are beating the hell out of each other. Like, there's just no other way to put it. In the meantime, these phantom, Twilight Runners. Why can I not remember the name of Twilight Runners? It's right here. Twilight Runners are, making their way closer to Blowhole. They kind of get tangled up with Trencher. Trencher knocks a couple of them out. He makes some comment about how about the stuff on the woman's face. He's like, I gotta tell you, babe, you're the ugliest woman I ever seen. And then Phoebe's like, Gideon, that's totally uncalled for. He's like, yeah, you're right, Phoebe. Sorry, Toots, you're actually Stone Raven Beauty, and the band played Believe in It If You Will. This is just the way Trencher talks. Mm-hmm. It's grating. So then Shadowhawk pops up again, and this time he's got like a big gun that he'd kind of like left on the sidelines. And then it's the reverse now, where he just is blowing Trencher to pieces, and now he's the one with all the gunshots or impacts all over him. So now Trencher's like laying in a pool of his own purple blood when the Twilight Runner nurse attacks Shadowhawk, claws his face, which I guess when he sees blood, is that a thing Shadowhawk's got? He doesn't like to see blood? I don't know what that was.
That'll come into play. They make a reference in the first issue of the miniseries talking about how a person in his shape shouldn't be doing this, and right. It's going to come into play in the later Shadowhawk 3 is when they're going to talk a bit more about, you know, that situation.
Why? I gotcha.
Foreshadowing.
So he he knocks the nurse out. Trencher's still out cold, and they show his fingers wiggling as he runs away to go check on Blowhole. We see now what's going down. What are we doing? So Shadowhawk gets into Blowhole's room, and there's two goons that are there trying to kill him, and they're about to off the dude. Shadowhawk knocks those dudes out, and then as he's like, you know, maybe I finally am here to protect this guy, there's a click at the back of his head, and it's one of the other, or I don't know if it's the same Twilight Runner, another Twilight Runner, who knows? It's just a black blob. We can never tell who these things are. With a in a cop's body with a gun to the back of Shadowhawk's head, and right before he's about to pull the trigger, who shows up? Trencher. Trencher throws the dude out the window because he wants to finish Shadowhawk off, and he's the one who wants to kill off Blowhole. Except now his like intestines are hanging out. There's bullet holes in his body. Like he's extremely jacked up at this point. And Shadowhawk is just completely taken aback and can't believe this is happening. And then Trencher punches him, almost knocks him out. He gets ready to kill Blowhole. Shadowhawk jumps up, dives at him, and literally like jumps through Trencher, like cuts him in half, like jump, but doesn't cut him in half. I mean, cuts him in half, right? Because he uses his Wolverine claws, but he basically bursts through him and cuts him in half. So he's like, finally, I got this. This dude's cut in half. I can't remember what he says. He's like, oh my God, what have I done? This is unreal. I'm going to be sick. Except Trencher's still talking to him. He's like, you're telling me, pumpkin. And he's like, what? Like, how are you still talking? Trencher grabs an electrical outlet and then grabs Shadowhawk and electrocutes him to stun him. And then the disemboweled body, I guess the top half of Trencher, launches himself at Shadowhawk, grabs him, and they start falling out a window, except they get hung up because of Shadowhawk's lower Trencher's lower intestine is like caught or is still attached to his legs somewhere in the room. So now they're punching each other, dangling from his intestines, hanging out of a window. Shadowhawk starts climbing up his intestines. This is outrageous.
Very Robert Rodriguez, yes.
Yeah. So, and then these cops are looking up, staring at them like, well, what should we do? They're like, I guess we just let them kill each other? Like, I don't know. So Shadowhawk starts climbing up while Trencher is telling him that I'm going to strangle you to death with my intestines, and then I'm going to get your intestines out, and then I'm going to strangle your own intestines. Like, just, he's like beyond, he's out of control, right? So Shadowhawk pulls out his claws, cuts the intestines, and climbs up what's left of them to get into Blowhole's room. Meanwhile, the now detangled half of Trencher's body falls the rest of the way down the building and into a cop car and explodes. Shadowhawk gets into the room, and I was like, this dude slept through all of this, like, because Blowhole's just sitting there snoring in his hospital bed. Meanwhile, the whole hospital's like been blown up. There are dead people everywhere. There's intestines everywhere. And then suddenly he sits up in his bed, and you see the Twilight Runner blob on his face. And the dude just gives him a little speech about how, you know, like, I'm going to shoot myself. I'm going to kill him myself. And the dude basically puts a gun to his head and pulls the trigger and kills himself. Meaning the Twilight Runner killed Blowhole by possessing his body and making him commit suicide. And so you just see a blam, and Shadowhawk is like staring at him, walks out of the hospital, and basically passes out in an alleyway because he's lost all control of his body at that point. Like, he's completely given up. Final page of the issue, they cut to, what is this, like a box or something? Is this like a Trencher thing? I don't know what this is. It's basically he's talking to himself in a box saying,
oh, you know what, you know, he's in the morgue.
Is it the morgue?
It's the morgue. Yeah, he's in a morgue locker.
Oh, it's, yeah, J-Doe. There's J-Doe, and then okay, I gotcha. So basically he's like putting his body back together in the morgue.
Yeah, I think Phoebe's working to regenerate his chassis.
Yeah, they're talking about what the next. And that is Images of Shadowhawk, folks.
So what did you think of your first exposure to Keith Giffen?
It was a wild ride, man. I'm really, okay, story-wise, I mean, there's not much there, but for what it is, it manages to stay fairly entertaining. I have to say that Trencher's dialogue is just, it's like the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
Like, it's like Ben Grimm to infinity and beyond. Like, it's like I am having to reread the bubbles because it's damn near gibberish, right? Like, it's so unnecessary. I don't get why they insist on doing it and going that far with it. But when you look at the artistic style of Trencher, and it's so over the top, I guess it fits. But man, I can only imagine reading like a Trencher solo series, that there's already so much to take in with the art, and then also having to decipher what the fuck this dude is talking about could be very difficult to handle.
Yeah, especially since so much of it is driven by him having conversations with Phoebe, the voice in his head. And so it's just him. And I imagine Alan Grant was probably basically writing Lobo, you know, and Batman. You know, he's a somewhat more vulnerable version of Batman, but that's sort of the dynamic. So the voices aren't necessarily 100% where they should be. In particular, we don't have any second person narration. So obviously that's not Shadowhawk, but it's not so far off that, you know, that's what a Trencher comic reads like. And a lot of people really didn't enjoy this miniseries as a result of that. This was not a time period where Keith Giffen's work was the most welcoming or accessible. And a lot of people have a negative reaction to that as a result.
And I can totally see that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
this would have been a really interesting single issue story, three issues. It's really stretching your patience too. I have to, you know, assume.
Yeah. And like when I started out, like my notes are like really detailed. And then I'm like, oh, like, no, this is the whole story. There's nothing else to keep track of. They're just going to fight over this guy. And then in the end, either they're going to save him or kill him. And he died.
And you get, and they give you the punchline too, where the mobster that had hired everybody to go kill the blowhole is the next target of Trencher. So, you know, he's doomed as well. Right. So like none of these characters are ever going to come back again. I wonder perhaps if the Twilight Runners were intended to be used in either Trencher or Shadowhawk at some point, but I don't think they ever come back. So it's a pretty pointless story. There would have been a pretty solid issue or two, but by three, you're just completely out of patience with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say I love this art style, dude. Mm-hmm. I don't know if what year was this again?
93 and 94.
I don't know if in 93 and 94, I probably would have like thrown up all over myself. But looking at it now, I have never seen anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe some of the weirder Sin City Frank Miller stuff, kind of, but this is like, there's nothing like this in comic. I'm sorry, there's nothing like this in comic. Like, I don't know, I don't even know, really know what I'm looking at. And I don't know how it is, I don't know how it's coherent, but it is. But I do see what you're saying, where the colorist has got
a
freaking enormous job to do.
Mm-hmm.
But dude, I would love the hell out of an original piece of Trencher art.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't even give a shit about Trencher, but I want an original piece, just from artistically, I want a piece of this. And it could even be from this miniseries. I don't care. Is it out there? Somebody had to send me a link, because
I've seen Trencher pages for sale online, so they are out there. I've not ever had a Giffen in my hand, to my recollection. But those pages are in circulation.
Yeah. So I'm looking at some black and white like covers and stuff, and it's as like jaw droppingly outrageous as I would think. Like I don't even know how do you color this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how. This makes no sense to me. I'm looking at Keith Giffen Trencher original artwork online.
How much is it going for?
I can't find any with prices.
We figure with everything going digital nowadays, it's probably any really, what would you refer to it, handcrafted artwork? Because like I have some artwork that has like the those zip tones and stuff.
Yeah,
that looks fantastic. You got to figure that stuff's worth more money now. Because I was looking at some artist and I was like, man, I would love to have a piece, and then I read and it was like all digital.
Oh, I know.
And
you know, all the backgrounds are just dropped in.
But I hate it. I watched Todd do, like, he was doing a Spawn. It felt like a cheat. Like he would kind of draw something and then he goes, and then I hit this little button and then I hit the cape and then the whole cape is filled in.
Uh-huh.
And I hit this button and then it shades it for me. And I'm like, well, you're not really fucking drawing anymore, are you? You're just kind of picking buttons and picking where you want the shade. I was like, ah, that really cheapened it for me.
Anyway, where were we? And looking at it in black and white, it's like, good Lord. Like, where does this jacket stop and the trash in the alley next to him starts and the car next to him and the explosions off the gun? Like, it's like, I need to paint by numbers this thing. Like, you need to put numbers so I know where to paint this thing, because it's so, so wild. So, yeah, like I said, in 92 or 93, 94, would I have liked this? Absolutely not. But now I'm just like, dude, I've never seen anything like this before.
And I'm the same boat too. I remember when I was buying the Trencher issues new, I really struggled with that artwork. And of course the stories were trash and they still don't hold up very well. But today when I look at the artwork, it's like, holy shit, what was this guy doing? You know, what was this guy on? It's crazy.
Yeah. Like, and to like, look, I guess Keith Giffen's got, I don't know if it's cause he just people, he endeared himself to people or what, but like who lets him do this? Now I know at Image he has a little more creative control, but I'm not going to say the gall, but to have the nerve to create something like this, I mean, a lot of people would probably be worried they're about to kill their career doing something something like mm-hmm. this. You know what I mean? Like, this is so, it is just so out there. But I kind of love it.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of love it. But again, I've seen it, I've got it in small doses.
Mm-hmm.
If I was paying, you know, $3 an issue in 1994 or whatever,
mm-hmm.
And then with the dialogue and stuff, it'd probably grate on me a little bit. But man, looking at these raw, like, art pages is, I could do this all day, man. Just mm-hmm. clicking through this stuff. This stuff's incredible.
So just to explain it, I think one of the reasons why the story was so dragged out is because the intention was to launch the book with art by Mark Texeira, who of course had co-created an abortive prototype of Shadowhawk with Valentino at Marvel. We talked about that previously. And unfortunately, Texeira never showed up, so they might have done these three issues and sort of vamped a bit to give him time to draw the series. And instead, he drew Union, and that book ran late. And he was also doing the Sabretooth miniseries for Marvel. I'm not sure if he had long lead time on that and like had already drawn it before he started on Union. But basically, Union in particular ran late, and he, for the most part, Texeira just took 1994 off. He just drew a few odd issues of various comics, I think mostly Punisher stuff, and he just didn't do anything else in 94. So I guess he made enough money off of those other projects that he didn't need to work.
Like I just sent a page to you in the chat. I mean, like, what is this? What am I even looking at?
Oh, yeah, that's from the Christmas special, yeah.
I mean, obviously, yeah, I can see the wreath up there, but...
You could definitely do an adult coloring book off of this page, for sure.
Bro, I would quit. I would quit. Like, if they sent this to me, I'd be like, this is a fucking joke. Like, you're fucking joking with me. Like, for real, dude. I would, like, this is insane. This is insanity.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
I got to send you some of the Kanzierski pages, because I'm not, I you could call me a coloring bigot, you know, because when I'm doing the credits, I pretty much drop off the colorist.
I mean, I call you that all the time.
Oh, yeah, totally. Because I don't list the colorist most of the time when I'm reading off the credits, and I know there are shows that go through everybody, and it's like, I'm sorry, but there are invisible arts, and I think that most of the time, coloring and lettering is an invisible art. I call it out when I think that you need to call out that particular person, good or bad. And Kanzierski could just do stuff for that artwork that nobody else could do. And it really was a perfect match. I don't know how it was that Giffen got with Kanzierski, but nobody could do any of that trench material justice besides him. So at some point, I need to show you some of the pages that he colored, and you can see what a difference that made.
I'm guessing they had the same drug dealer. You guys are both doing the same shit. Maybe you should work together.
Well, actually, and Kanzierski did have a character that he was going to do a creator-owned book called Speed, so there might be something to that.
Oh, does he live on Lakeshore Drive? Or yeah, it's crazy. This is just crazy shit. This story is really, it's nothing, mm-hmm. but like, after a while, I mean, you just stop reading the balloons and just look at the action, and I think you kind of have to appreciate it, especially now that I'm digging into some, no offense to Jim Valentino, but it's like Jim Valentino's normal Shadowhawk stuff is so basic. And here's the other thing. So you know, the joke is that Shadowhawk's helmet doesn't make any sense, right? Mm-hmm. It makes no sense. It cannot. It's like an M.C. Escher drawing. Like, where does it start and stop? And is that a fold or an edge? Like, nobody can tell. It actually, like, makes more sense with Keith Giffen drawing it like this. I'm like, this is the most sense that helmet has ever made is in this Trencher comic book. Ironically, it's just very, very bizarre. And it's just so, then I'm going through regular Shadowhawk stuff, and it's just like, man, this is so boring mm-hmm. compared to the
low rent Batman. Yeah.
Yeah. Real. Not that he doesn't have his occasional splash page that he puts a little extra into, but I mean, this is, you know, it's like, where are my squiggly lines at? And now I'm just like, man, I would have liked to have seen this page if Keith Giffen would have done it in the mm-hmm. Trencher style. It would have been like way more interesting. Anyway, that's that. I don't know what significance this miniseries has in anything. So this is images of Shadowhawk, mm-hmm. like images of other characters?
No, the whole point was they were going to do Legends of the Dark Knight for Shadowhawk, and it never came about. And the actual name images of Shadowhawk, I think, was derived from a card series that came out, where various artists interpreted the character. So it almost like was just an extension of the branding from the trading cards, I think, is where that came from. And unfortunately, the series never continued. So it's just this mini series with a name that doesn't make a lot of sense in the context of the one story that was produced.
So it was going to be like Marvel Comics presents Shadowhawk, and they were just going to tell Shadowhawk stories with different rotating.
Yeah. Well, I keep saying Legend of the Dark Knight. That doesn't necessarily mean anything to you. Basically, what they did is they had an anthology series where they would essentially incorporate straight miniseries into an ongoing book. And so this creative team would do three issues of a story set in Batman's year one period, and it wouldn't relate to the next story with a different creative team set in roughly the same time period. But since they were not intended to be set in continuity, you'd have to worry about where it really fit in, just basically the general time period. And you just have this series of miniseries. They're all under the name Batman Legend of the Dark Knight, and with a continuous numbering. So you would buy it as though it were an ongoing series, but really what it was is a continuous miniseries. It was a continuous series of miniseries.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay, cool. Yeah, now we're on. Yeah, I've never read Legend of the Dark.
So, I'm trying to think of Marvel. I guess Marvel never really did that. Now that I think about it, I'm trying to think of an instance where Marvel had a book like that. I thought they tried to do that. Yeah, that's right. They did try it with Spider-Man very briefly on a book called Web Spinners. But that lasted maybe a year or so. So it's not something that has an analog at Marvel, you know, that you would be like, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about now. You know, they just never did. Even Venom literally was a series of miniseries that were actually an ongoing series. They just would do a new number one, but it literally was the same creative teams telling a continuous story as though it were an ongoing series, but getting that one issue, first issue bump a couple or three times a year. So there's nothing at Marvel that really is a parallel.
Okay, let's get on with the Spawn stuff.
So we got, I think, maybe three episodes of Spawnometer out last year. And the other show that was covering Image stuff, All the Pockets, I think that it's not had an episode for the entirety of all of last year. All of the Spawn Image-related shit that I know of that's out there has kind of fallen, pod-faded, or just it hasn't been up to the task. This year is the 30th anniversary of Image Comics. It's the 30th anniversary of Spawn. It's the 25th anniversary of the movie Spawn. I really want to try to step up the game and try to get at least 12 episodes out this year, you know, at least one a month. I want to
I think we should do two a month.
We got to actually work that out though, because we're not, you know, so that'll be a team effort. But I want to at least try to get one out a month, and I want to make sure that at least one episode for each of the Image founders. That's the goal.
Okay.
So we'll work on that and try to get to that place. In service to that, the episode we're working on right now is going to be heavy with Shadowhawk. I've basically got a sequence that I recorded with Mac a while back. You were there for that, because that was that weird night where we were tag teaming and one of you would be reading and the other one would be talking. And then I did a solo sequence for the back end where I just barrel through Shadowhawk 3 because we just need to get it out of the way. We don't have to spend a ton of time on Spawn 33, but I did want to give a little bit of context for the issue. It was released on July 13, 1995, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. This was the same month that John Byrne began his 3-year run on Wonder Woman. This was the first month of a Nightwing number one miniseries. This was the one that Greg Land did that showed that there was still an interest in Nightwing as a solo character. Before long, he got his own ongoing series and more or less has not been without an ongoing series since that point in time. And given that specifically George Perez's time working on the character of Dick Grayson transitioning from Robin to Nightwing was hugely influential on all of the Image creators, it seemed like the majority of them. So for me, it's somewhat momentous that this was one of their characters that they grew up on, finally getting his start as a soloist, long deferred. This month marked the release of Avengers The Crossing. So I'm sure that Mac has a black armband from that time period, the death of his precious Avengers and Tony Stark. This was also the month of Double Edge Alpha, which was the start of an event that led to the fairly temporary death of Nick Fury and also the cancellation of Punisher's line of titles for the most part. They had one that lasted like a year or so, and then there was no Punisher's titles for a while until Marvel Knight. This is the month of Mark Gruenwald's last work on Captain America after 182 issues, including a decade as the series writer. This was the month that Wizard the Guide to Comics number 49 was released with a Joe Madureira cover. And I think that's notable because after the Image guys left and they got all those guys that kind of looked like Image guys and none of them really took off, or if they did get any traction, it was after they'd already been poached to Image. There hadn't been another group of superstars yet. And I think that Joe Madureira getting that cover to Wizard is the start of him becoming the more regular penciler on Uncanny. He'd been doing it off and on, trading out with Roger Cruz and Brian Hitch, but within this time frame, he starts to consistently get the book out and becomes a huge talent that, you know, is one of the the last of the superstar 90s artists. And of course, he does eventually end up at Image. But I think this was sort of the dawn of the first wave of people that made their bones that weren't the Image guys, but had that sort of Image heat behind them. Okay. You had the release of Dark Horse Presents number 100. You had the release of Oblivion number 1 from Kimiko. Oblivion was one of the last books that Kimiko put out. This was after the company had been bought by Andrew Rav, the guy who now owns like half of everything Rob Liefeld ever came up with. And so this was like the last hurrah of him being in comic books in general. Pretty much the death knell of Kimiko. So I think that's notable since we're seeing the industry start to transition again. You also have from Image Comics the release of Team One Stormwatch and Team One Wildcats, which give you a backstory on the Image universe dating back to about the 50s or 60s, and kind of shows where the Wildstorm seemed to have a greater sense of creating a history and a creative, a sense of a greater cohesive universe than most of the other Image guys have managed so far. This was also the month of the reliefs of Wildcats number 21, the first issue written by Alan Moore, which if we don't progress with our other Image stuff, then we don't get to Alan Moore Wildcats, and we both want to cover that.
Gotcha.
So Spawn number 33 is Shadows. It's written by Todd McFarlane, drawn by Greg Capullo, inks by McFarlane. They had a bunch of other guys that they think that probably contributed to the inks, but nobody that there was such a long list that I didn't think it was worth going through each one of those people, but I'm sure they all helped a little bit. And the issue is dedicated to Gene Colan. You're familiar with him?
Yes.
From what?
Did he used to write comics?
Gene Colan? It's always interesting to me to find the blind spots with folk. So I'm surprised.
I know the name. I know the name, but I don't know where I know it from.
Like Tomb of Dracula.
Oh, okay.
The Silver Age Daredevil. He's the guy who did that smoky, wispy, like even when he was inked, it still looked like pencil, like gray tones and stuff. You have ever since Howard the Duck he did. He did a bunch of stuff. Not really still ringing any bells for you though, huh?
No.
I want to say that probably McFarlane read Tomb of Dracula. It seems like he likes the stuff that's like the hybrid horror superhero type shit. And so probably he's paying tribute to Colan doing that sort of thing that he ended up doing with Spawn. So what did you think of the cover? This one has Violator dunking Al's head in sewage.
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, it's a Spawn cover. You don't know how those play out.
He still kind of looks like a page from inside the comic more than the cover though, right?
I mean, it's a good cover. It's a Spawn cover, dude. What do you want me to say? It's a Spawn cover.
What happens behind that cover?
It always looks like an 80s heavy metal, like the next part where some dude's like clipping shit off to kind of get the Spawn. And it's his costume that's being clipped, right? Or the symbiote. Oh, we can't call it a symbiote, can we? What do we call it?
I want to say they might have called it a symbiote at some point, but no, I don't. That's not the actual costume, I don't think. That's you've got somebody who's making a voodoo doll that looks like Spawn.
Oh, okay. I thought it was actually parts of the costume that he was cutting.
I mean, it's conceivable it might be, because I mean, we pretty much know who that is, right? I mean, we're going to play coy given that the Violator is on the cover of the damn comic book.
Well, that's true. Is the Violator?
It's the clown, yeah.
I thought it was going to be that crazy guy. You know what I'm talking about? Not the freak.
No, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the curse.
Yeah, I thought it was going
to
be him.
No, because remember, the same guy's talking to the homeless dude later on in the book, so we know that it's the clown.
That's true. Okay, so yeah.
But again, it's always weird to me, and Spawn is real bad about this, where they'll be really coy about who a character is, and they're on the goddamn cover. So it's like, I'm pretty sure it's the clown. Like in your case, it actually caused some confusion. You're like, oh, I think there's another subplot. It's like, no, it's the fucking guys.
Yeah, I thought it was a subplot. I'm like, okay, this must be like the whole fucking Doomsday thing where they're doing something in the background while we're actually reading the main story. Okay.
Yeah. So he makes the voodoo doll. He stabs it in the heart because that's what you do with the voodoo doll. And he talks about how he's going to strike at the heart of Spawn. Not that we really necessarily see that.
Yeah. Again, he doesn't have a heart. He's a fucking bag full of protoplasm. We've already discussed this where he doesn't really have a body.
Well, I think he's meaning the metaphorical heart, like he's threatening to attack Wanda or Sign or some shit.
Okay. Well, then damn it, say that. Okay, yeah, okay. I see. You're right. Now, I thought it was that Spawn is having a debate with all the other gentlemen in the alleyway about him leaving. They're all fighting. I was like, I don't know. I just thought that was kind of...
Well, elaborate on that. What's going on in that sequence? Because I mean, it's all prompted by Blood Feud and that one group of homeless guys who tried to kill Spawn and betray him to the vampire dude. And his buddies are like, we don't know those guys, you know, yada yada.
So they're all, he's talking about leaving because he keeps bringing, you know, danger to the alleyway. And everyone's getting, you know, people are getting killed because of him. And they're like, you know, no, you know, you should stay. And so one of the guys is like, dude, you're just pussying out. That's it. Like, you know what? You need a man up. You know, I like that line where he says, you know, I, you know, for my Vietnam War days,
A good soldier follows orders. So you follow who gave the order. You take care of that problem. And I was like, dude, finally some sense. Like, so, and that's the same character that was killed that he brought back to life.
Yeah, that's so, Bobby. And I like Bobby, that they're still keeping the scar, the Rosetta, rosacea from where his head wound was healed and shit. And I like that he actually says, if I could, I would have killed Chapel, but he was already dead by the time I was being resurrected. So that wasn't really an option.
Because, I mean, that's kind of some of the, to me, my opinion, the drawback to Spawn at the time is he's so wishy washy, like I should do this, but I want to do that. I need to do this, but I got to do that. And I'm just like, he's not very. I mean, his main drive is Wanda, over and over, Wanda. But I don't know. At this, I mean, he does bring upon himself a lot of heartache because he's fucking up and people are coming after him. But and he does kind of go after them, like when he got the files and stuff, and he was able to blackmail. But it was not. It's nothing permanent. It's just like just enough to keep them at bay. Where this guy's like, no, you need to get out there. You need to fucking take them head on and take them out. Slit their throats and let them lay kind of attitude. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then of course the little spy takes off running. I forgot that Twitch got hurt from the last time we did one.
Yeah,
and Todd really.
We read Blood Feud at the exact right time because all they're doing is showing the after effects of that. You know, we've got this debate between the homeless guys, and it is true that they were always in peril. They were always getting hurt. This would have been the time period like the money heist shit where or money train heist. Shit where they're like setting homeless people on fire in real life and stuff. Remember that shit? And then even in this book, you've got like the cops running over people in alleyways because they're rushing to the scene of a crime and not realizing there's people living there. And you know, so these guys were always in danger. So it's a fair counter argument going on there. But you're seeing like, again, Twitch is in the hospital because the last time we saw him in Blood Feud, he'd been stuffed into a fucking locker and broken and shit.
Yeah. And so I like the fact that, you know, Burke's like, you know, we're going to get him. I'm going to work your case. And he's telling them, you do whatever it takes to get them. Like, my pain is nothing compared to what those families are going through. And I was just like, all right, that's cool. Like, that's cool to me. I don't know. I like that Twitch sees the world around him. Like, he's just a small cog. He's like, you need to get out there and take care of these people. Like, there's a bigger problem out there. So a little bit of self-sacrifice there. And then,
well, and also Sam is still fixated on Spawn. And we tend to see Twitch in a somewhat subservient role, even though he's also he's sort of the Alfred too, though, where even when he seems like he's deferring to Sam, he's also busting his balls the entire time. And he's pointing out, we're not worried about Spawn. Deal with fucking Chief Banks. Deal with fucking people who are protecting child molesters and murderers and shit. You know, that's who you need to be worried about right now. And they've got all that fucking dirt on the Chief. And he's basically like, you know, go ahead and do something with that. And it's interesting too, because we've heard mention of his kids. We've seen that one kid of his that he used as bait in that one story. But we're actually seeing like, no, they've joked about him having a ton of kids. I think what, 6 of them show up, including the one hot jailbait daughter of his.
Okay.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not, it's just, they definitely like, you know, he's running around in what, like belly bearing shirt and shorts. And
I know later on we see Twitch's wife and she's like smoking hot.
Okay. Yeah.
She's like out of his league type hot.
Yeah. I think Twitch has a pack in some heat.
But my bit, I was going to say, Frank, you'll always be my Twitch, but never mind.
Actually, I'm sorry, but that doesn't sound good anyway. That sounds like an HR comment there. I don't want to be your Twitch.
Well, I meant like my Alfred.
I get you, but it's like that particular nickname. Hey, now I'm starting to wonder what that nickname means exactly. I'm wondering where he gets that from. Is that sort of a tell before he's about to conceive another child? What the fuck?
So trigger happy with the kids. And so next we see the Violator spy come and talk to him and let him know that Al's talking about leaving the alleyway. But then we go straight back to the Angels where the last confrontation with Bomb, where he blew up half the building, and they're talking about how, you know, Raphael telling him, who's Raphael talking to? Tiffany's talking to Raphael.
Yeah. This person's named Tiffany. Now she's kind of a mousy chick with glasses, sandy blonde hair. She doesn't look like the person we're going to come to know as Tiffany, but my understanding is that's the same character and that's like her human form or some shit. Yeah. I think that's mine. If you go to the Spawn Wiki, they show her as the human form of the Angel Tiffany that's going to come on later on.
Okay. And then I know that. Huh. Well, she's telling her how, you know, not to get too upset because they all figured like the Spawn costume was that, or the Spawn symbiote was acting just like they would have acted. kind of a self-defense type thing. So yeah, she's upset because apparently they're putting him behind schedule on several things. Next, we'll go to Jason Wynn. And, you know, the whole Terry thing. They just kind of touch base with. They kind of give you like a touch base of what's going on with everybody.
Yeah, the whole issue is aftermath of Blood Feud, which it's funny because this is still an ongoing miniseries at the time the comic book comes out.
Oh, really?
And just advancing the subplots. You know, Wynn is still twisting in the wind, and Terry Fitzgerald has officially transferred into his department. So Fitzgerald is taking Bobby's advice without having actually heard anything from Bobby. He's going after Wynn. And I still feel like Terry Fitzgerald is the secret hero of this book. I feel like he's the guy who's doing his best to get shit done and working to the best of his abilities and has real things to lose in his life and is still doing what's morally right. You know, he's the guy who actually acts heroically throughout this series.
I can see that.
You continue with
that. Okay, so, no, what Terry is like kind of the main hero of the book. He's always, all he's doing is trying to protect Wanda, his daughter, and bring justice to Al's murder. Where Al kind of is all about Wanda. That's his main focal point. And then fucking with people that fuck with him.
He's still too passive, still too reactive, still doesn't use his noggin. His skull is full of green snot. Not a lot of activity going on up there, it seems like.
And so next we see the Violator speaking to his spy. Oh, no, it's Bond, right? Because he mentions the three things to set him off.
Yeah, the rat-faced Simmons. Homeless dude that we've only ever seen in this one issue talks about, calls him Al Simmons, and he's all, you know, why did you say that name? Why did you say that name?
Yeah, and so that was, again, I don't know. And the guy comes like, I was just told to say these things, and that's it. That's it. I'm just the messenger. And he takes off. Spawn, does Spawn follow him back to where he went, or does he know where the Violator is?
Well, no. What he did is he's like, he tells the rat-faced guy to go tell his boss he knows where to find me, knowing that the guy's going to scurry back to his boss's lair, and he's following him from the rooftop, just like typical superhero shit.
Yeah.
And you get that one page where they really take advantage of the all-black costume. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it looks great.
Kind of in a Daredevil pose.
And of course, when the little rat-faced guy shows up, Violator does what Violator does, rips out his heart. And that's when Spawn shows up and he sees the body landing on the ground, the heart landing on the ground, and chases him under the sewer. Well, no, he gets close to the manhole lid, and then the Violator reaches out, grabs his leg, drags him down there. Why do I feel like I've seen this in a Spider-Man issue? These posing.
I can't think of a specific circumstance, particularly because I didn't read much of McFarlane's, but
maybe it was a Savage Dragon. Maybe a Savage Dragon. Dragon issue.
Well, in the third issue, he is in the sewer fighting the Spider-Man, whatever they call that variation on Spider-Man. Or was it one of those things where they took out the hyphen, you know, whatever they call that dude?
Yeah. I don't know. I remember seeing this. I'm like, I've seen this pose. Now, granted, this is probably a pose used a million times in other books too by this point.
I actually watched a video the other day, yesterday, in fact, I think it was, where apparently Dave Finch does art seminars now on YouTube for Patreon and shit. And he was showing, taking an Alan Davis drawing when he wants to like freshen up his poses and finding ways of altering the pose and altering the perspective so that you're not just copying the same thing over and over again. Whereas I think McFarlane has a little bit more of a Wally Wood vibe where it's like, hey, if I do it once, it worked, I'm going to do the same damn thing again. So I think that's, I tend to agree with your opinion on the matter.
I appreciate that. I have some good opinions once in a while. And of course, Spawn and Violator do what they do. Start fighting, ass kicking. That's a great page with the Violator wrapped around the Spawn kind of fighting. And
I like that he's tugging the tongue of the Violator as part of the fight. Very Looney Tunes, but it works in the true context. Yeah, and Violator's on a rant because essentially the whole reason why any of this is happening is since Spawn was talking about wanting to leave New York and get away from imperiling his loved ones, a Violator doesn't want to, like, it's weird because Violator just went on a road trip. You know, he was in Washington, D.C. when he got busted by Bad Rock and shit. So I don't know why he would feel the need for how Spawn stay in one place. Maybe because he wants to roam and know that Spawn's going to be where he left him. But the whole thing is the threat in Spawn, like, I don't want you out of my sight, you stay here. And talking about, you know, what an honor it is to be a Hell Spawn, how he's been a farcical example of Hell Spawns, and just basically slagging on him, but then also kind of tripping out because he's like, how did you you morph your suit so early on? It's supposed to still be incubating and you've already morphed it. How the fuck did you do that? And so it's this weird thing where he's supposed to be, you know, running Spawn down and you know, negging him or whatever the fuck you want to call it, what he's doing. And at the same time, it's like he lets it slip. He plays himself where it's like this guy's doing shit that Spawns aren't supposed to be able to do, and he's tripping out on that shit.
Okay. And apparently, so as they're battling, because these sewers were so old and never taken care of, they bust a line and they're both drowning in like sewage water or just this murky water. They kind of get separated. Spawn pops up, and of course we see the clock again.
Yeah, 6887. And we do learn something else too, is they make it clear that Spawn can't breathe turd. He despite being made out of necroplasm, he still can be drowned, or at least it causes him some trouble, and so he insists on continuing to breathe.
I'm telling you, he doesn't breathe, man.
He says he breathes. Maybe it's one of those psychosomatic things. Like
that's what I'm saying. It has to be psychosomatic.
He
thinks he breathes, but he doesn't. I'm telling you, dude, he's just, I thought about it the other day, dude. It's like if you took a plastic bag and filled it full of liquid, that's Spawn. Well, there's nothing inside. There's maybe a conscious to the plasm, but there's not a real body there. I really do believe that when he's attacked and he gets, I believe he probably doesn't feel pain, but because his human brain or that consciousness part of his brain tells him, you just got hit, that would hurt, he reacts to it.
It's phantom pain.
Telling you, I would love the fact that somewhere down the line, they're like, yeah, he never felt any of that shit. Like he's just this fucking, you know, bag of plasm that has a consciousness and reacts to you, you know, but it doesn't really feel pain. It doesn't really, you know, I think that would be cool because I hate the fact that it's a body underneath there.
My thing too is even if I had the ability to breathe in a cesspool, that doesn't mean I would want to.
Not true.
You know, there's a lot of things I could do that I have the human ability to do that I would choose not to do.
I think we've discussed it. He doesn't breathe, so he wouldn't drown.
He speaks, so therefore he draws breath and exhales breath, or he couldn't speak. But
that's a good point.
The mechanical process versus the necessity of that process.
Are we sure it's not like some kind of psychic Martian Manhunter thing where he's just talking to him through and they're reacting to him?
Maybe. I mean, maybe, but I don't. I tend to think not.
His mouth is covered.
Yeah.
His mouth is covered a lot of time. What if he's speaking and they hear him mentally?
And he's a corpse too. So it's like, obviously those aren't full functioning lungs. He's a rotting corpse, so his lips are pretty much gone. His tongue's probably mostly gone. So really, how is it that he suddenly sounds like Keith David, you know? It's like, he should probably have less good voice than that.
I'm telling you, dude, right down the line, Spawn needs to be like, oh yeah, Spawn never spoke. It was all, like, everyone heard him, or the suit would give off vibrations like a voice, but Spawn wasn't really speaking.
But that's one of those things where you got to hope that Alan Moore touches on that in one of the miniseries or something, because you know Todd himself isn't coming up with that shit.
Nah.
I mean, I'm sorry, I've mentioned it before, but I've tried to read the post-300 Todd McFarlane Spawn shit, and him trying to make his own teams and all this kind of shit. I couldn't. I had to stop. It was fucking awful. Not only does he not get better as a writer, he gets considerably worse as a writer. And I think that the length of time that he spent away from actual good writers who know what they're doing is showing. Like, when he would read an Alan Moore script and then he could riff off that, he could do better stories, where he hasn't had anybody worth a shit write his character in a long fucking time. I mean, maybe these new series that are coming out, because I haven't read any of the Satellite books. I've only read the core Spawn and that Spawn Universe special that came out. But
have you read any of the new stuff, like the Top Hat Spawn or whatever the fuck it is?
I did not. I don't think I read King Spawn or Gunslinger Slinger Spawn in their own books. I read the Spawn Universe one shot. There was an extra length, not quite an annual length, and it gave samples and like did preludes to those spinoff books. But it wasn't any great shakes either. And I think he wrote that one. He might have had co-writers on that are the people who are writing the proper series. But it didn't. I wasn't inspired to read any more past that special. I read some more issues of Spawn afterwards, but I wasn't happy to have done that. Again, can breathe. You know, just because I can breathe a cesspool doesn't mean I want to. I don't want to read one either. So what did you think about the issue? Anything really thought-wise?
Setup issue.
Yeah.
Probably was.
Not too much.
Everybody's just kind of still doing their stuff, you know, no major changes. Because really, the fight between Spawn and Violator had no point.
Mm-hmm.
It, just like Violet and like, look, I'm still here. I'm going to fight you. We're going to fall in this war. Like there was no, I don't know. It just, it didn't
there was literally no reason to do any of that. So Violet could have, hell, Clown could have just walked to the alley, said his piece and walked away. Like sure, all that set up and using the homeless guys as errand boys and shit. It's like none of that mattered. None of that was necessary.
So it's definitely a filler issue.
Solicitation copy for the Shadowhawk soundtrack. Shadowhawk 2, The Secret Revealed, The Comic Book Experience. In collaboration with Image Comics, Animated Alligator has adapted all three issues of Shadowhawk 2 into audio form. With an exciting cast of characters, digital sound effects, and a musical score that will knock your socks off, this comic book soundtrack will recreate every word of Shadowhawk 2 series in high style. The audio soundtrack will be available on both cassette and compact disc. Each copy will feature colored artwork from Shadowhawk 2 on the insert and an imprint from the Shadowhawk line on the face of the disc cassette. Releasing in February 1994, this offer will follow the release of the trade paperback due out in December 1993. The compact disc retail $18, the cassette retail $10. Note, neither the cassette or compact disc release will include the comic book itself. This is an audio companion to the books and can be enjoyed with single issues of Shadowhawk 2.
I've got Christina. Damn. This time they're close. Maybe a little too close. What if next time they hit the mark? There's police headquarters. Do I go in Terminator style?
Hey, look up there! It's Shadowhawk!
Beautiful. I couldn't have planned it any better. I'm out of range of their bullets. And a positive ID of me will exonerate Christina. By the time I get up here, I'll be long gone. Now, real question is, how will we pay for her injuries? What with Carlton still critical, my condition worsening.
Excerpt from Inside Image issue number 9, cover dated November 1993. Shadowhawk 3, Through the Past Darkly, an interview with Jim Valentino. By Laura Tavishanti. Shadowhawk is a vigilante, not a superhero. He's not a role model. He's a man named Paul Johnstone, an ex-DA, who got so fed up with the court system that he began taking the law into his own hands. Then, too, there is an undercurrent here about the nature of heroism. Where are the lines? What actions cross those lines? These are underlying themes. Knowing who he is only part of the puzzle. The next question one must ask is why. What would make someone put on a suit of armor and go out into the night? What would make someone think that breaking spines is a reasonable solution to the crime problem? His origin is the subject of Volume 3, and I believe the answers it provides will shock you. The Regulators, Vendetta, Arson, Vortex, Blackjack, and Hard Edge, appear throughout the series. Current plans call for them to literally take over issue number 2. Their story will come to a close in issue number 4 of this series. We're also bringing back the Liquefier, and we're showcasing a brand new villain that was created by Chance Wolfe called Deadline. Chris Wozniak is currently working on a 3-issue Slaughter solo series, which looks red hot. Chris recently did our Ashcan of the Pact, which was tipped into Volume 2, Number 3. The Pact will also get a 3-issue series, which will be plotted by me and written by Lynn Sinicall, with pencils by Walter McDaniel. The others is, unfortunately, still up in the air. I've got 2 issues fully written and laid out. They guest star Infinite, and it's a good story, but I can't find anyone to draw it. It's very frustrating trying to hook up talent to project. All of these series will be solicited upon completion, and not a moment before. The Shadowline arm of Image is committed to on-time delivery. The interview or asks about images of Shadowhawk. Well, there's a good example. Our artist, one of the very best in the business, incidentally, got overcommitted. He couldn't make our deadline, which is 4 months prior to ship date. So we're not soliciting issue number 4 this month. I will not solicit a book that might ship late, even if it costs me money. We work very hard to get our books out on time, and I've got a great support staff to help me do that. From Chance Wolfe to Brad Foster to Frank Lopez and Rob Schwanger on the creative end, to Steve, Laura, Randy, Diane, Glenn, and Jennifer on the office end, all our efforts are geared toward getting the book out. To this end, no one's afraid of a 70-hour work week, if that's what it takes. I finished reading and taking notes on Shadowhawk 3 in April of 2021. I'm not going to read it again. I'm not going to drag Illegal Machine into the mess. I'm just going to kind of blaze through this as quickly as possible. Shadowhawk 3, First of Four, featured red foil enhanced cover. It looks nice enough, but it's not nearly as inventive as the ones in the previous miniseries. It's listed as Volume 3, Number 1. The first issue is dedicated to Frank Miller. Every day, Christine writes the book. She's been essentially chronicling the journey of the Shadowhawk project from the beginning, with the recognition that most probably neither she nor Paul Johnstone are going to get out of this situation alive. It's also acknowledged that Carlton has died from Kaposi's sarcoma, which is a form of cancer that often took the lives of people who developed AIDS back before there was the full regimen of treatment, you know, in the pre-Magic Johnson days, basically. We still haven't been let in on who exactly Carlton is, though. Then we check back at the hospital with Vortex and her broke-back brother. She's crying about, why would anyone care about what happens to just another Puerto Rican girl and her innocent mija? Despite having a toddler at home, she just can't let go of her need to avenge her estupido bro. Hard Edge is also there, and these two have a strange relationship. Vortex is still wary of his advances and wonders why he has a vendetta against Shadowhawk. The New York City's mayor office decides to serve up Captain Frakes to internal affairs over Slaughter's shenanigans. A suddenly woozy Shadowhawk is attacked by Vortex and Hard Edge. We get flashbacks to Paul Johnstone growing up in Harlem, getting caught stealing. Public defender Richard Woodrow helps get the kid off. Woody and his silver tongue got young Paul off the hook and formed a bond between boy and man. Richard Woodrow took an active interest in young Paul's life, from the healthy competition of athletics to the rigors of academia. He became the boy's father, first figuratively and in time literally. He inspired the youngster to continue his education, becoming a lawyer like himself. And no one was prouder at Paul's graduation, save perhaps his mother and his younger half-brother, Hojo. Finally, aging mobster Antonio Scrapelli wants to teach the new female Don Vendetta a little respect. And to this end, he's hired Deadline, spelled D-E-D. There's a new character created by inker Chance Wolfe. There are actually several characters introduced in this issue. Another one created by Chance Wolfe, Valentine, is the backup feature. We're not going to address that right now. We'll come back to them at some other date. Shadowhawk 3, number 2, featured a metallic ink enhanced cover featuring silhouettes of a leaping Shadowhawk and some buildings against some lightning. This enhancement is even less impressive than the first issue, actually by far, to be honest with you. This issue is titled The Needle and the Damage Done, after the Neil Young song, and is dedicated to Murphy Anderson. I can't tell whether or not Deadline is a white dude or a black dude. He wears a red and white costume with gold armor. He has so many spikes. He crashes a dinner party that Vendetta's hosting, prompting retaliation from the present regulators. Deadline carries an electro whip, which he uses to choke out Arson. As Arson tries to recover, Deadline does the same to Blackjack, but in this case, it seems to be the electrical charge that does the most damage. Deadline ultimately escapes rather than doing any significant harm to anybody. Meanwhile, Christina asks Paul about Hojo. He went off to college, majored in economics, his gaze firmly fixed on Wall Street. He joined a frat, had some fun, usual college stuff. He got himself into some minor trouble, but luckily the officer who busted him was an old college friend of mine. I never did thank Lou for making sure he was okay. Well, after college, he got himself a job on the stock exchange. He worked hard all day, and he played just as hard all night. He enjoyed the club scene around town. That's where he got introduced to drug, and the drug of choice for his crowd was cocaine. At first, he was snorting it, but soon he was freebasing. It didn't take too very long for him to graduate to crack. It consumed him. He lost everything and didn't care. The pipe was his life. Before long, he was reduced to selling the stuff on the street or hustling tourists and commuters for money. His suppliers were hardcore criminals and mob type. When they found out his brother was a DA, they withheld dope from him, promising a reward if his brother would fix a case for some associates of theirs. He came to me pleading, begging me not to prosecute, claiming his life depended on it. I told him I would help him get a new life, but was resolute in my refusal to aid these drug dealing scum. I needn't have bothered. The bastards went free on technicality, and I knew the trouble was on its way. I just never dreamed how much. I was working late one night when two goons busted into my office. They held me at gunpoint. The big guy pummeled me, while the skinny guy held my arms and laughed. Finally, I slumped over the desk, bleeding profusely, and waiting for the release of consciousness. Then the big guy pinned me down, while the skinny one pulled out the syringe. Christine continued, I remember you coming home to tell me and Carl about it, and how helpless we felt, all of us. I remember insisting you go get tested, and that terrifying walk up those steps. Back to Paul, I remember going back to work, the noticeable difference in how people treated me, the sidelong stares that bore into my soul, the whispers behind my back that reverberated like screams inside my head, and Hollis, that insufferable bigot at the water fountain, telling me a vote had been taken, and they didn't want me to contaminate their water supply. I remember how good it felt to deck him, to let some of that frustration out. I wound up in jail for that one, the threat of a lawsuit looming before me, the very real probability that my career, my life, was now history. You came to bail me out, using the last of my life savings, and then you told me about your being suspended from the force. It was a red letter day all around, and then we went back to the clinic, where our worst fears were realized. The doctor droned on in his cold monotone. I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson, but you've tested positive for the human immunodeficiency virus. You are HIV positive.
No!
After the Darth Vader scream, there is a full-page, all-text piece by Jim Valentino discussing the very real threat of AIDS and HIV and the discrimination directed at sufferers, especially in the early 90s. Things are obviously a lot better now. Back then, it was felt like HIV, AIDS was a death sentence. To some degree, it was. But again, we were at the cusp of things getting much better thanks to new medication on the market to help to maintain over indefinite periods of time. I mean, Magic Johnson's still with us after coming up positive 25 years ago, 30. Issue number 3 features an unmasked Shadow Hawk raging against the rain upon a gargoyle. No enhancement this time. Story's titled When Comes the Shadow, and the issue is dedicated to John Byrne. After receiving his diagnosis, Paul wandered the streets of New York for hours and days. Some street punks started to hassle him. He flipped out, started to fight, but they ganged up on him, beat him down. In my last seconds of consciousness, I prayed that I would bleed on them, and that my blood would make them die. After all, they were the ones who deserved this, weren't they? Paul's best friend Christina met him at the hospital, offered her and Carlton's limited exoskeleton, and now you know how Shadowhawk was born. Meanwhile, in the present, Captain Frakes has been suspended, and he gets drunk in a strip club with Jack. Hard Edge and Vortex were already on Vendetta's shit list, and when they finally show up at her townhouse, what have you, it's uncovered that this whole time that Hard Edge has been working for Scarpelli. Hard Edge fights a losing battle with Blackjack, and then Deadline shows back up again. Scarpelli's two metahumans double-team Blackjack. Vortex doesn't seem to be involved in the action at all, and then Shadowhawk shows up. Jamie Antoinette seems to have been in a news helicopter this entire miniseries. She just keeps doing reports from a helicopter. I think that goes back to Shadowhawk 2 even. Like, the only thing that sets her apart from the likes of Vicki Vale and Lois Lane is that she seems to do it all from a newscopter and then does her own reporting live on the air. Hard Edge is getting triple teamed. His force field was weakening, and he finally called out for Tatiana Juarez, spelled with an H, to finally help his ass. Vortex has misgivings because he's mistreated her. He's threatened both her and her baby, but finally she's like, I love him, and then she accidentally brings down the entire building. Unfortunately, her baby was also in the building, and so she freaks out and everybody starts trying to help find the baby, even Shadowhawk. Things get really weird though, and some random homeless guy shows up and lets the people know that the baby wasn't actually in the building. The baby had been snatched a couple of hours ago, and the guy had seen the whole thing. The kid was taken into the underground and given to the Underlord, and then the issue ends with yet another full page of text about facts on HIV, this time appearing to come from the Center of Disease Control. And there's a page noting that there's a Shadowhawk Down Under tour. Image Comics and Jim Valentino are making stops in Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane. In this issue, they also take the Wizard trading cards and turn them into full page pinups. Finally, Shadowhawk 3, fourth in the series, Shadowhawk Saga number 11 stamp on it. No cover enhancement. There's obviously a pivot happening at this point. Stories called With Friends Like These. This issue is respectfully dedicated to the memory of Jack Kirby, the greatest creator our industry has ever known. May he rest in peace. There's also, I noticed that Liquefier created, trademark, and copyright 1994 by Aaron Valentino, used by permission. I'm assuming that's his son. So we get some more flashbacks of Johnstone and Christina training with the exoskeleton. I don't know if we knew before, but apparently Carlton's Chinese and has a stutter. He is the Q of the operation. Paul notes that he's named himself after a favorite old superhero, setting up a bunch of pastiches to come. Shadowhawk, Vortex, Hard Edge, and Blackjack are then seen in the sewers. They're attacked by bums on their way to a giant cavern. Apparently the homeless community of New York, the ones that aren't hanging out with Spawn, maybe the same ones that hang out with Spawn, I don't know, has formed an underground cult that worships the Liquefier as a god and feeds it babies. While our anti-heroes fight the Liquefier, Vortex manages to talk one of the robed homeless people into giving her baby Beto back. I don't know why O'Rourke didn't use his experiences with Shadowhawk and Liquefier to help him beat Ted Cruz a few years ago. It's a very compelling story. Finally, Vortex obliterates the Underlord against Shadowhawk's protestations. Of all people, Shadowhawk. No, Vortex. It's an intelligent being, not a monster. You don't realize how precious life is. Everyone, everything deserves to live. So I can break its back. What happened to Liquefier? Did she vaporize it? Did she send it into another dimension? All that's left is a glob of acid ooze. I never imagined Vortex was that powerful. I doubt anyone did. Either an act of stunning cowardice or to set up a spinoff, the members of the Regulators decide they're going to head out west, sans Hard Edge, and I guess leave Vendetta to her own devices. And we're left with a final splash page pinup of Shadowhawk against a whole bunch of really ornate buildings. Titans. Images credited to Valentino, Wolf, and Foster. I leave them without looking back. I'm smiling under the hood. My body feels weaker. There's no question about that. But my spirit is stronger. I may not be the knight in shining armor I wanted to be, but I do feel good about helping Vortex. And for the first time in a long time, I feel good about me. And the letters column is full of more AIDS talk, as well as a picture of Jim Valentino looking lovingly at Bill Clinton as they pass one another at an event. You can just barely get both Valentino and Clinton in the same picture as he's just like doing a line shaking hand and signing autographs and shit. Definitely putting a date marker on the comic book for sure. So do you remember the origin stuff for Phil Johnstone though specifically?
Yeah.
Like how he was an attorney and his brother was a drug addict and a gambler and shit, and the mafia came and tried to make him like help them in the DA's office, and when he wouldn't, they injected him with AIDS infected blood, and then he started hanging out with these ex-cops who made an exo suit, and that's how he became Shadowhawk. Any of that shit ringing any bells?
No. Yeah. That's fucking insane.
I have to wonder, because Jim Valentino shared a studio with Rob Liefeld, and Rob Liefeld had his character turn up with HIV, and it was a motivating factor for his character, and then Jim Valentino turns around and has a character who has the same motivation. Do we think that Jim Valentino, like, was it parallel thinking, a man thing, swamp thing kind of thing, or was it that Valentino saw what Liefeld was doing and wanted to do his own take on it, or was it that they were sharing a studio that Liefeld knew what Valentino was going to do and then fucking sniped his ass and did it before he had a chance to do it himself?
Yes.
Yeah, we agree, right? Liefeld probably stole that shit, right?
I'm no Liefeld fan, but yes.
No. I'm saying, so do you think that Valentino was inspired by Liefeld, or do you think that, because the origin came out after Chapel's origin stuff, or is his motivation stuff. So the question is, do you think that Valentino was doing the same thing, or was it that he had the idea first and Liefeld stole it and used it before he could use it?
Well, quite possible. I mean, I think what it is that was just a hot topic subject at the time, and they were both like, hey, this would be, like, no one is doing this in the book. I had never heard of that, you know, any characters going through that at the time.
Yeah. Well, and it's possible, too, that maybe Valentino saw what Liefeld was doing and was like, we need to do a little bit more serious take on this, because he went deep into that. Like, multiple issues had multiple pages devoted to legitimate resources, you know, frequently asked questions, dispelling. He was, like, fucking Snopes-ing that shit back in the day. Like, he, you know, it was like that episode of 21 Jump Street where Brad Pitt's got HIV and nobody wants to drink milk after him and shit. And, like, Jim Valentino's all going Johnny Depp explaining, no, it's okay, guys. He took it seriously. So maybe he just wanted to address the topic more seriously than Liefeld did.
I think they just used that as kind of like to make it more contemporary to what was going on around them. I don't know.
Well, it's just like all these, they've talked about that in some of the documentaries we've watched. I think either All the Damage or Image Revolution, where it's like all these guys were young dudes listening to hip hop who thought being black was cool, and they all did a bunch of black characters in the comic books, which was a real break from what would typically be expected of comic books of that time period. It's like there's a lot of black representation in this early Image material.
Yeah.
And so by the same token, when somebody like Magic Johnson comes out with HIV, and even before that, Eazy-E, a guy who actually went to a signing and talked to fucking Rob Liefeld as a fan, that's probably going to impact on these guys because they know this dude. You know, they may not be hanging out with him all the time and shit, but they know that there's like a mutual appreciation there, and they're very conscious of Eazy-E dying from AIDS and shit.
Yeah.
Going to do the spawning ground now. Tumblr for episode 27, Trencher featuring Mr. Monster. Apex Grodd added the comment, someone forgot to tag as Tracer's Heaven. So a little bit of a diss on old Giffen there. So for Twitter, we've got some spawning from 20th Century Geek Podcast, Adriano, Alex Chung, CH, Canoes, Chris Dunford, who added excellent, Chris Leiden, Del Dracula, Doc Strange, Dr. Pop Culture BGSU, Ed Moore, Edward Hui, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Hulkling, I Was Joe Is, Jason Snicked Venable, Jeffrey Brown They Them, Jocktastico, King Size Comics Giant Size Fun Podcast, Christados, Longbox Crusade, Lukashin Sergey, Marvel Universe Online Project, Mike It Send Aliens to Me, Nuka Carl Quantum, Siskoid, Sue Kent Ant, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tim Price the Podcrasher, Trekker Talk, Two True Freaks, You Should Be Listening, Under the Influence, Warlord Worlds, Who Is Rob, Non-Participation Trophy winner Willis and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace podcast. Finally, we got a long comment from Jeffrey Brown. Now, here is an Alan Moore comic I haven't read yet from his short run on Spawn. And I definitely own issue Spawn number 32, mostly because I wanted to see how he got his even spikier costume. I am familiar with Tony Daniels' art from titles like X-Force post Capullo, leaving Marvel to work on Spawn. Hey, I do. Do you think it's funny, Frank, that McFarlane got X-90s X-Force artists to work on Spawn? I did like both Daniels and Capullo on Batman when I was reading Batman. I also want to say I kind of like Kevin Conrad's inking over Tony Daniels' pencils. It's very McFarlane looking. I'd like to get your thoughts actually on those comments.
Okay. On the inkers or what?
Huh? Yeah. The like inkers? For instance, what would it do? Could you see the difference between Kevin Conrad's inks and, you know, anybody else's, for instance? And particularly over
time? Not really.
Yeah. I can see Conrad's difference. I thought he did some good inking work. And if I remember correctly, really? I actually got him to ink a piece of mine that Shane Davis did. He was good on that. But yeah, I can see the difference in his inking. I do like it. What do you think about McFarlane pulling all the X-Force guys to work on his books instead of letting Liefeld have them?
There was some turmoil in the group, wasn't there?
Yeah, but I mean, Liefeld didn't exactly have dibs on Marvel talent, you know, so whoever could poach from Marvel.
Wasn't Todd the bigger name?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And Spawn was the bigger comic book and was coming out on a more regular basis.
So I think that was the bigger draw. It's like, look, I can work with a guy that has a name and has a book. If I remember correctly, like, Youngblood was very sporadic.
Well, it was weird because the core title wasn't coming out on a regular basis, in part because it was expected to be drawn by Liefeld, and Liefeld wasn't getting it out. He took that sabbatical and shit. But you had Team Youngblood coming out on a regular basis. You had a Strike File coming out irregularly. You had various one-shots and miniseries and shit. So there wasn't a lack of Youngblood content out there. It's just the core book wasn't coming out on a regular basis. And I think the point was for Team Youngblood to fill the gap until Liefeld wanted to get around to doing the core book again.
Okay.
I do mourn for the lack of a Greg Capullo Youngblood, even one issue. I think that Capullo would have done a pretty good job drawing the Youngblood characters. He probably just didn't want to have to draw teams anymore. But it would have been really interesting to see him either draw a team book or maybe do something like Prophet.
Capullo on like Pit.
Well, that book wasn't coming out on a regular basis either. So I could see him on Pit. Especially with the Timmy. Greg Capullo drawing Timmy would have been just fine, I think.
Style.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he kind of did because he did the Creech, and the Creech was kind of like a mashup of Pit and Max anyway.
Well, no. Yeah, I guess it was like a Pit / Fuji mashup. Okay, yeah.
And let's see. And then what about Tony Daniel, though?
Like his artwork?
Well, it's like they got him from X-Force and they brought him over to do Spawn stuff. Do you think that he should have been doing Youngblood stuff because he had done Liefeld's old book? Do you think he was a better fit Spawn?
I think a better fit for Spawn, because you look at his 10th stuff, it was really good.
I wasn't really into his X-Force to begin with. I know that it was in that Image style, but I don't think he was ever a good fit for that book. He definitely is a better fit for Spawn. And really, early Capullo, or actually in this period, Capullo versus Tony Daniel, to some degree, I find them interchangeable. I definitely think that Capullo is the stronger of the two artists, and I can't see the difference between them. But if I'm not actively like looking at it, they kind of look enough the same to where you could slot one or the other in, and it wouldn't make much of a difference in terms of how the book is received by me, because it kind of still feels like the same book regardless of which of the two is drawing it.
Yeah, I mean, look what Capullo did on fucking Batman. I mean, his art style just—I really like his art style.
I like Capullo too, but I still would have liked to have seen him do a little bit more team stuff, because I thought he had a good sense of team dynamics and making the individual members look different from each other. And I thought he was also really good at the paramilitary stuff, which he, aside from Spawn, got away from to a large degree. It seems like I like him drawing guns and combat fatigues and shit like that.
Stellar Studios presents An Into the Weird and A World on Fire production.
Starring, in alphabetical order,
Brainwave Jr.,
Fury,
Jade,
Northwind,
Nuclon,
Obsidian,
The Silver Scarab,
The Star Spangled Kid.
These are the members of Infinity Inc., the protégés and children of the legendary Justice Society.
Created by Roy Thomas, Jerry Ordway, and Mike Macklin, their 1980s adventures are chronicled at last by Herman Lowe and Billy Dee. Two podcasters with way too much time on their hands, but dedicated to analyzing, glorifying, and sometimes vilifying the stories from the team's first series.
So hop in your Star Rocket Racer, switch on the radio, and let's rediscover the Earth 2 we'd all like to go back to. Star Rocket Radio, an Infinity Inc. podcast. Soaring through the Podosphere since September 2021.
Hey Ryan, I know we're taking a break from Batman Nightcast, but I've been thinking about the Nightfall storyline, where Jean-Paul Vallée temporarily took over the role of Batman.
I see where you're going with this. If you were ever paralyzed, I would be honored to take care of Cindy and your kids.
No, that's not where I was going. I was thinking about all the many characters who have filled in for Bruce Wayne as Batman over the years. Dick Grayson, Tim Drake.
Commissioner Gordon, for some reason.
Yeah, that did happen. Anyway, on the subject of temporary replacements.
Your son Andrew is going to take over Supermates?
No. Focus on Batman. Why is this so hard? While we're away from Nightcast for a while longer, someone could come in and do a Batman-related show for the Fire and Water Network.
Well, I know Paul Keen loves the Batman Family comic book.
I've seen Sean M. Myers post a few things about Batman Family, too.
Do you think they'd...
We'll do it! For those of you who aren't familiar with the series, Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978, and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980.
The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even Ragman and the Demon.
So you're all invited to the Batman Family Reunion podcast, taking over the Batman Nightcast feed.
Coming in January to the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
This could be the sensational podcast find of 2022.
We are Venomaniacs is the Venom Site's official podcast for all of your symbiote news, reviews, and point of views about Venom-related comics, movies, television, animation, and merchandise. We are available on Podbean, Spotify, Apple Music, iTunes, Google Play Music, and YouTube. Join us, won't you?
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!